My name is Chris O'Leary, and these are the Sins of the Fathers. Episode 2, The Second Sin. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, at the Church of the Immaculata in Richmond Heights, Missouri, which is a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, I was sexually exploited, abused, and raped by a priest named Father Leroy Valentine. Then things got really bad. Because things got so bad, I'm actually going to start the story at the beginning, because otherwise you may not make it to the end. The gist is, the phrase, the courage of Christ, is one that I never really understood. But the act and process of coming forward has really helped me understand exactly what that means. When I thought about and considered coming forward to talk about my abuse, it terrified me. And, you know, in retrospect, it was that terror was completely justified given what I'm facing now. The thing that allowed me to do what needed to be done and to come forward was the image of Christ riding into Jerusalem to a certain and known fate on Palm Sunday and doing it anyway. If he can do that, then I can do this. I can talk about this. I can do what's necessary. And if you're not a religious person or not that religious, other people that I had in mind when I was thinking about coming forward and actually coming forward were Jackie Robinson. You know, the way he came into baseball and took the abuse that he did and knew that he was going to take that abuse and took it with grace and, you know, and ended up integrating baseball is just amazing, an amazing example. And it probably cut a few years off of his life, and I'm willing to bet that he knew that, and I'm willing to bet that he was okay with that, especially given how improved racial relations are lately. Other people I had in mind were Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Medgar Evers and the other civil rights leaders who, again, faced death, and in the case of Dr. King and Medgar Evers and many others, actually died as a result of what they did. And while what I'm doing is terrifying, and I do wonder if I face some risk of death, the risk I face isn't what Jackie Robinson or Dr. King or Medgar Evers or Jesus Christ faced. And if they can do that, then I can do this. So that's the message. One message I hope you get out of this. You know, if you have something very difficult you're dealing with or something very difficult that you need to do, I hope you will learn to look to models and use that to strengthen you, to draw courage from. So in the previous episode, episode one, I talked about what happened, you know, the events leading up to, surrounding, on, and after that day, the day that the worst stuff happened. In this episode, I'm going to talk about the aftermath, in particular, what it was like to try to get help from the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And it was, just to be honest and to warn you, it was a terrible, terrible process. Everything you hear about processes and assistance for survivors is it's a scam, it's a fraud. There's no there. So my abuse occurred in late 70s, early 80s. I really had no sign of, or I had no knowledge of what was happening and the connection between what had happened to me when I was a kid and what was going on. But that started to change in March of 2002. A New York Times article ran, which talked about three brothers, the Scorfinas, and how they had alleged that Father Leroy Valentine had abused them, not at Immaculata, but at one of his subsequent postings. So what I actually did was, as part of that article, they asked anyone who had any information to call the prosecutor's office, Jennifer Joyce, and the archdiocese and come forward if they had any information. And I knew, you know, I was one of Father Valentine's favorites and had spent a lot of time with him, and I didn't have any. I have one memory. I didn't have any memories that are explicitly bad, but I did have one memory that was kind of questionable. Everything else I mostly just treasured and thought it was really cool and neat. And, you know, some of it was secret stuff, but that just made me feel special because, you know, he was trusting me with secrets. But there was one memory that was a little bit off, which is one that I talk about in episode one, which is driving home from the mud cave trip, where I have come to suspect that he molested me, and that was no fun. But so in March 2002, I never heard back from Jennifer Joyce in the prosecutor's office, but I was relatively quickly called back by then Bishop, now Cardinal Timothy Dolan, who's in charge of New York now. He called me back within a day or two. I told him my story, and he very quickly, during the same initial call, said, he essentially told me nothing happened, that he knew Father Valentine, he lived with him, he was at the seminary with him, he knew that Father Valentine would never do anything, any of the things that he's accused of, that he would never do anything to hurt a child. But then Bishop Cardinal Dolan told me, but, you know, if you want to talk to someone about this, we've got someone that we work with who I can refer you to. And I don't know for sure, but I believe that her name was Nancy Brown, and I believe she was the assistance coordinator for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. But she told me the same basic thing, that, you know, nothing happened, you know, the stuff that I remembered, I was just misinterpreting what had happened. I misinterpreted his actions or his intentions. And I had a newborn, you know, a baby who was a month or two during that whole process, and three other kids. So I was just crazy busy. And to be honest, I just put it out of my mind. You know, Cardinal Dolan, who I trusted and who I'd known since at least third grade, told me nothing happened. And that was good enough for me. Plus, you know, a psychologist, Nancy Brown, also told me nothing happened. So I just kind of put it behind me. What I didn't know was that at the end of March 2002, a couple weeks after I came forward and then talked to Cardinal Dolan and Nancy Brown, Father Valentine resigned due to someone who came forward. I don't know who that was. I don't know if that was me, but I was never notified that Father Valentine had resigned, and I just missed it in the papers. I don't know if it was actually published in the St. Louis papers. I know it was published in the New York Times, but I don't regularly read the New York Times. But no attempt was made by the Archdiocese of St. Louis to circle back to me and say, well, you know, those stories you told us about Father Valentine, maybe those did mean something. Maybe they weren't nothing. That never happened. And that was true of both Archbishop, now Cardinal Regali, and then Archbishop, now Cardinal Burke. They were basically, at the time of March 2002, Regali was in charge, and then Burke took over, and neither of them ever circled back to me and, you know, and let me know or asked, you know, okay, Valentine resigned, we accepted his resignation, maybe there is something to your allegations. That never happened. They just ignored me. And I didn't know to be bothered by that because, like I said, I was just ridiculously busy with four kids, including a newborn. The first thing that happened to me that was kind of questionable and that I recall vividly was in February 2003, I took my older son to make his first confession at Mary Queen of Peace, our parish, and I had what must have been a panic attack. Basically, as we approached the confessional on the west wall that was manned by, I believe, the pastor of St. Elizabeth, I got more and more agitated to the point where I started crying when we were next in line. And, you know, I managed to hide it from everyone, and I had no idea what it was related to. But by the time I got into the confessional and went into the face-to-face side, because my son went into the kind of standard sliding door side, I was just completely in tears and emotional and everything. And I made some excuse to the priest and just got out of there as fast as I could. And that was weird, but it didn't really, it just seemed kind of random. I didn't connect it to anything. Then, either in the fall of 2004 or the spring of 2005, a Law and Order episode named Eos Foros ran, and it was basically, it was a reenactment or retelling of the story of the murder of Madeline Murray O'Hare, the atheist who was killed, I think, by family members or someone close to her in her church. And what I remember about that, what stuck with me about that, is that there's a scene in the movie where, I guess it's the female perpetrator, they take her to a hotel room or a bedroom where she was supposedly raped or attacked or something like that, and she has no reaction. And the female detective makes a comment to her about how trauma victims, when they are brought back to the scene of the crime, often have a reaction, and only then did this, you know, the female suspect have a kind of a phony reaction. But that idea that victims revisiting the crime scene after the fact tend to have reactions, panic attacks, whatever, that really stuck with me. And I didn't associate it with that first confession panic attack, but then in February 2005, my older daughter made her first confession, and the same thing happened. I had a panic attack as I took her to first confession. This time it was on the east wall in Father Meyer. She again went into the sliding door side. I went into the face-to-face side, and I just made some excuses to Father Meyer. But, you know, I very obviously broke down and had this huge problem, and I started to wonder if I mean, it was obvious to me, I'm not stupid, it was obvious to me that I had a problem with confession, and I didn't know what it was connected to, but I started to wonder. So then later on that year, September 2005, I contacted Lori Goldstein and the other writer who wrote the 2002 piece talking about Father Valentine's abuse of the three Scorfina brothers. And I don't remember exactly why I did it. I think it was obvious to me that I had a major problem with confession, because I'd had two panic attacks. I'd never had a panic attack. Well, I'd had two panic attacks when I was a kid, but, you know, I hadn't had a panic attack in 20 or 30 years prior to that. That just wasn't me, but suddenly I was having these panic attacks. So I contacted her and just kind of asked her some basic questions, the gist of which was, I asked her if she believed the people who told, that if she believed the Scorfinas, the people who she wrote about in the story. And she told me, we wouldn't have run the story if we didn't believe them. And that really kind of stunned me. I didn't know how to process it, and it wasn't a eureka moment. It actually, it was the opposite of a eureka moment. I kind of shut down and didn't explore that anymore. I had tried to contact the SNAP director, but which is an abuse survivors network, but I never did anything with that, because it was just from that point on, just thinking about the subject just made me dizzy and woozy. And, you know, and the other thing was, what I used as a mantra, what I kept repeating over and over in my head, was nothing happened, nothing happened, nothing happened, misinterpreting what I had been told in 2002 by Cardinal Dolan and by Nancy Brown. You know, these were people I trusted, and they told me nothing happened. And so despite what this New York Times reporter said, you know, the people that I trusted told me nothing happened. So I believed what I wanted to believe, which is that nothing happened. Now, coincidentally or not, I started having major problems at work, getting more and more withdrawn. That was exacerbated by kind of political problems and a bad situation at work. But, you know, the timelines match up very closely, where I started kind of psychologically disintegrating from that point on. It also didn't help that my older son, the one who I'd taken to confession, by that time was turning like 9 or 10, which was the age that I was when things started and when I started serving. And I started obsessing over him, and I couldn't stand to leave him alone at practice. Couldn't stand to leave him alone with other people, particularly adults, and that started interfering with my work. But I wasn't. It was a problem, but I wasn't aware that it was a problem. I was in denial. You know, it's very much like an addiction or, you know, a drinking problem or whatever. It was very obvious in retrospect that I was having major problems, psychological problems. But I wasn't able to connect that to what had happened to me, to my experiences with Father Valentine. And again, you know, Cardinal Dolan told me nothing happened, and Nancy Brown told me nothing happened. So, you know, I believed. They told me what I wanted to believe, and I believed what I wanted to believe. So then I started having major problems at work and having a harder and harder time concentrating. At lunch, I would have to go driving, and I would just drive and drive and get away from the city. And, you know, it started taking, you know, I'd take 45 minutes or an hour, and then, you know, like a year or so into the process, 45 minutes or an hour wasn't long enough, and I'd end up going for 2 or 3 hours, and I just had to get out of there, and I had to get out of St. Louis. I would just drive west of St. Louis. And things got bad enough that by July 2007, people had noticed, and this frustrates me, they had noticed and described me as having become catatonic. Nobody ever told me that, which frustrates the hell out of me. I was working at Equifax by that time, but people saw that I had become catatonic, but nobody tried to help me. But so they laid me off in July 2007, and that didn't help at all. The obsession with baseball that I had kind of developed over the course of the prior year got worse and worse, and I was literally unable to think about anything else. And I didn't understand why. I tried, you know, I ended up writing a book about, you know, the elevator pitch and doing some work on innovation, but I was unable to think about anything besides baseball. Some of which is because, you know, that's what my son was playing and that was what he was really interested in, but there was also something about me that couldn't let go of baseball. And I also started to have this weird feeling that I call man suit, where essentially I feel like I'm walking around in a man suit, very much like the Tom Hanks movie Big, where he makes a wish and gets turned into, you know, he ends up a kid inside an adult's body. And that's very much how I felt. But the problem was that I had no idea why I would feel like that or how to stop feeling like that. It was just, you know, at weird times that feeling would come across me. But again, I didn't think about anything about it because nothing happened. You know, Cardinal Dolan told me nothing happened. Nancy Brown told me nothing happened. So obviously it couldn't be related to my experiences with Father Valentine. Then in early summer 2008, I think it was June, Laura and her mom took the kids to Colorado to a dude ranch. And within a couple days of their leaving, I had this episode as I was driving west on Adams, which is a road that runs through Kirkwood right by the Y in Kirkwood. I had this episode where just this wave of maybe it was fear, but it felt like rage and anger. And it was maniacal and lethal and just absolutely terrifying. I guess, you know, in retrospect, I guess it was PTSD. I don't know what the trigger was. It was probably the fact that Laura and the kids had left and I was worried about them. You know, I'd been, as they drove out to Colorado, they went through Kansas and ended up having problems with a tornado and that was right by their hotel. So maybe there was some fear there, but I didn't, again, make the connection. But it was pretty obvious that I had this kind of really strong PTSD episode where I wanted to kill people, but I didn't want to kill people, but that's what the feeling was like. And the way I solved that problem was I stopped leaving the house basically as much as possible. I just stayed inside as much as I could, because staying inside and particularly staying around the kids allowed me to manage that feeling and keep that feeling at bay. As long as I was around the kids, you know, A, I was distracted at a minimum, you know, coaching them and everything. But it was just like the more, you know, when I was around the kids, that didn't happen. And when I wasn't around the kids, it did happen. I assume that was PTSD, but I didn't make the connection again to Father Valentine because Cardinal Dolan and Nancy Brown had told me nothing happened. But, you know, obviously that started having major economic impacts and causing economic problems. You know, how do you make money when you can't leave the house? I tried to solve that problem by writing, but then that was problematic. And I did and still do sell a baseball product, but, and that has allowed me to survive, but because I have difficulty leaving the house, I, you know, I'm not able to make that exactly what it could be. In December of 2008, I went on a AXE retreat, which is basically a kind of a Catholic renewal retreat, you know, where you're supposed to get closer to the church and closer to your faith and everything. And I really enjoyed it up until the point where I realized that part of the process was going to confession. And it was, because it was at a retreat center, the only option was face-to-face confession. And the way they set it up was, it was like the library or something like that, or a reading room, and they would just set up two chairs facing each other in the library or a reading room, and then it would just be you and the priest in there facing each other. And that seems really nice and warm and everything, but the problem is that is exactly how things were set up when I would go to confession with Father Valentine. So that, and again, I didn't make the connection. It seems stupid, but I had a panic attack, and the first time I believe it was Monsignor Pieper, and it was in a room that was on the north side of the complex. And I just went in there and I just melted down and I didn't know why. And I, you know, this, the same thing happened that had happened to me back in 2003 and 2005. I just collapsed. But again, I didn't make any connection with that because nothing had happened. And by that time, I think I was seeing a psychologist and was I was dealing with some marriage stuff, but then we kind of shifted into trying to understand some of what was going on with me and why I was having the difficulties I was. But again, I never talked about Father Valentine because, you know, Cardinal Dolan had told me nothing happened. Then, well, and things deteriorated such that by February of 2009, I was thrown out of the house by my now ex-wife, just because I had, you know, the whole catatonic thing and not being able to leave the house and having trouble making money and all the stress that created. So I was thrown out of the house in February 2009. The divorce was finalized in January of 2010. And, you know, obviously that took a toll on me. And it freaked me out because, you know, as I said, the only way I could kind of sort of manage this stuff and keep up my productivity was knowing that I was around the kids and that I could take care of the kids and they weren't in any trouble when, you know, as long as I was there. And now suddenly I'm divorced and I'm it's much, much more difficult to be able to see the kids. And, you know, my ex-wife didn't make that any easier. It was pretty much as terrible as it could go. And that caused me lots of problems. And I don't know exactly what the root cause was, if it was the divorce or what, but I had an elevator pitch presentation in March of 2009. And I was, you know, and I was hoping to use that as kind of a springboard for a consulting career in terms of communications, that kind of stuff. But for whatever reason, I was utterly unable to think and to prepare for that presentation. So while the presentation wasn't a disaster, it certainly wasn't what it could be. And the problem was, is I just couldn't think. I guess some of it was, it was probably all just anxiety. But there was also the fact that, you know, I was away from the kids and I had to travel, which normally would make me feel better. But because I was away from the kids, I think that freaked me out because I wasn't able to be there and protect them. But that was just a disaster. And I made a little bit more money off my elevator pitch stuff, but that experience went so badly. And it wasn't just the experience of doing the presentation, but all the feelings that I had in trying to put the presentation together, and the fact that, you know, just how terrible I felt leading up to that presentation and trying to prepare for it, that really ruined me. And I didn't know what to connect it to, because I'd never had any problems with presentations before. You know, I'd been doing presentations and speaking at WashU, talking about innovation, and then suddenly, you know, completely out of the blue, I'm utterly unable to prepare for a presentation or be able to speak in front of people. And that just, you know, what am I supposed to do after that point? Because I'm completely boxed in. There's, you know, I don't have any other option, because, you know, what am I supposed to do? I can't leave the house. I can't even do a presentation outside the house. How am I supposed to make money? So, you know, a year or so later, April 2010, I was on team for another Axe retreat. Instead of being a retreatant, I was on the team. And I again had a problem with confession, because as a team member, you still did a lot of the activities, including confession. So it was the same basic setup, except the room I went into was on the south side of the building, and it was Father Meyer, and I just had another massive panic attack and completely melted down. He was nice about it. That was actually the second time that I'd had a panic attack in front of him. I don't know whether he clued into that or remembered the first panic attack I had, but he was very nice about it. But it was obvious that it was, you know, I had this problem with confession, and I actually started talking about my problem with confession and talking about how difficult it was. I gave a talk as part of the retreat process, and talked about forgiveness and started talking about the problem with confession. And I started to make some connection between what had, you know, again, I'm not stupid. You know, this was the fourth panic attack that I had in context with confession. And I'd always remembered going to confession with Father Valentine. I never had any really negative, you know, thoughts with respect to that. It did, over time, it kind of creeped me out, and I would get a little squirrely because he would hug me and the hugs would go on longer and longer, and my head would always end up in his crotch somehow. And I would feel trapped, but that wasn't an overwhelming feeling. But by April of 2010, I had, you know, it was obvious that I had a problem with confession, especially face-to-face confession. But that was the extent of it. And I just thought it was only affecting me, you know, as a Catholic. And when I would try to go to confession, I had no sense of connection to the bigger problems that I was having. You know, and I was still mostly unemployed, obsessing about baseball, making enough money to survive off of my baseball knowledge, but I was hardly, I was hardly excelling and hardly realizing my potential. I was still having extreme difficulty in terms of leaving the house, and still having what in retrospect were obviously problems with PTSD. And I was seeing a psychologist, and basically we had shifted somewhere around that point from talking about my marriage and my concerns about my kids and trying to manage all those feelings. And we started to get really practical, and we started talking about my productivity problems and why I was having problems making money, and how and what I could do about that. And that then got me into, up to that point, I had seen something like 9 or 10 psychologists. So I was on my 9th or my 10th psychologist, and had always avoided the topic of Father Valentine, but for a couple reasons, one of which was kind of the man suit stuff. I started to wonder if the man suit stuff was related to Father Valentine, and then obviously, you know, it was obvious that the confession stuff was related to Father Valentine. Even though I didn't remember any of the bad stuff, I remembered, you know, how many times I'd gone to confession to him and the hugging and everything. And I remembered as I got older, I started feeling more and more squirrely. So it just, you know, I ran out of other options. I explored every other diagnosis, Asperger's syndrome and ADHD and anxiety, and none of that really worked out. But it was obvious I had a problem with depression and anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, in 2010, 2011, I started talking about Father Valentine with my psychologist and started talking about events. Now, again, as I've talked about before, that was a very long and lengthy process because he didn't want to implant any memories in me. He didn't ask me any questions. I just had to kind of throw what I thought was random stuff at him. It turns out in retrospect, it wasn't at all random. It was, you know, it was all related to this, but it was stuff that I had been hiding, but I never brought it up previously because I thought it was random. But that's really stupid because it was just all this abuse stuff that was just staring me in the face, but I didn't want to see it. I couldn't see it. Such that by Holy Week of 2011, I decided. And we had had some discussions. I had had some discussions with my psychologist about abuse and whether it meant anything, and whether it meant anything big, and whether it could be related to the problems I was having. I was starting to wonder if my interactions with Father Valentine could be in any way be related to the problems that I was having. And I asked him about this, and my psychologist repeatedly said, "No, you know what you're describing. You know, it's a problem, and it's a problem for you at church, but it's not a big problem. It doesn't explain the bigger issues that we're dealing with." So I just started kind of digging and throwing at him what I thought were random thoughts, but I could tell that he was starting to wonder about stuff, and I was starting to wonder about stuff. So Holy Week 2011, I called the Archdiocese of St. Louis, with the intention of asking them a simple question. Are you sure that this stuff doesn't mean anything? Are you sure that my memories of Father Valentine, especially the ones not just from confession, because I was pretty sure that those memories meant something, that, you know, they only meant something in terms of confession. Okay, so I couldn't go to confession. You know, I guess theoretically that's a big problem for Catholics, but it wasn't that big of a problem for me. You know, I had no problem confessing my sins privately to God and kind of giving it up to God. That was how I managed it. But I was starting to wonder if the bigger life problems that I was having, you know, bankruptcy, divorce, problems with my family, inability to leave the house, I was starting to wonder if that kind of stuff, the really debilitating stuff, was related to my experiences with Father Valentine. So in early May 2011, I met with a review team from the Archdiocese of St. Louis. It was led up by Deacon Phil Hankin, who was the head of the Office of Child and Youth Protection, the predecessor to Sandra Price. What instantly freaked me out about walking into that meeting was I had read the documents and the processes and procedures trying to, you know, prepare myself for what it was going to be like. And those documents said very clearly that there were not supposed to be any lawyers involved. And as I walked into the room to meet with the team, I realized that there were two lawyers at the table, the Huegers, Bernie Hueger, and I think it was Christine Hueger. And Bernie Hueger's a name that, you know, comes up a lot when it comes to abuse. And he was kind of the point man back at the time. I don't know whether he's still doing work on those cases. But so Bernie Hueger, so on my right was Deacon Phil Hankin, and then behind him was Bernie Hueger, and then to my left was an older female psychologist, you know, 60 or so, then Christine Hueger, who took notes because, as Deacon Hankin said, she had the best penmanship. Barf. Yeah, he was that guy. He was a pretty terrible person. And then behind Christine Hueger was an ex-cop named Malachek, and I remember that name, and I remember his face because I went to high school with a guy named Malachek, and they looked identical. I assume they were related somehow. He denied it, but I don't really believe that. But, you know, the lawyers thing really kind of freaked me out because I didn't know or even think to bring a lawyer. But I was still, at that point, naive, and I'm like, okay, well, they've got this process, and they want to help me, so I just told them my story, and I walked them through everything that I've talked about, you know, in episode one, all the things that happened before, on, and after that day, all those memories, all the stuff that I've talked about, you know, today, basically exactly the same stuff, you know, and with the intention of wondering, you know, are you sure these don't mean anything? And one of the interesting kind of troubling things was that they told me that they had no knowledge of my meeting in 2002. My conversations with I had at least two, maybe three conversations with Cardinal Dolan in early March 2002, and my mid-March 2002 conversation with a female psychologist who I believe was Nancy Brown. They had no knowledge of that. They had no idea what I was talking about. Well, at least the people on the left side of the table had no knowledge of that. I thought, I don't remember exactly what the reaction of Hankin and Bernie Hueger were, but I remember that most of the questions that I got about, you know, what did they look like, where was their office, that kind of stuff, those questions came from the left side of the table, which was the older female psychologist and the cop. The lawyers were both quiet, and Hankin didn't really say anything. So I wonder if the Huegers and Hankin actually did have knowledge of that meeting, and it was just the female psychologist and the ex-cop who had no knowledge of my 2002 conversations with Dolan and then my meeting with Nancy Brown. This is, I mean, it's hard to process, but while they acted like they were interested at the end of the meeting, and the meeting was cut short by Hankin and Hueger. Hueger's the alarm on his phone went off, and Hankin, at about an hour and 15 minutes into the meeting, asked me, you know, so what do you hope to come out of this process with? Which I took as a signal that the meeting was over. I hadn't told them everything, but it was obvious that they had heard what they wanted to hear, or they'd heard enough. So at the end of the meeting, they told me they were going to take, they were going to discuss my findings and take it to the review board, and as I was leaving, Deacon Hankin gave me his card, and on the back of it, and I still have that card, he wrote a name of a book by Frank Pittman called Man Enough, and I very quickly ended up buying that book and read it. I probably read it about 100 times or so, because the gist of the book was that everything was my dad's fault, or the implied message that I got from reading the book Man Enough by Frank Pittman was that everything was my dad's fault. But what really freaked me out was that I didn't see myself in any of the archetypes that he presented. There were three or four archetypes, and I didn't see myself in any of them. And it just, it didn't make any sense to me why he would recommend that book when it didn't seem to have any relevance to my situation and didn't have any resonance with what I was feeling and with the problems I was having and, you know, just kind of what I was. It was describing people that, that simply weren't me. And that was the start of a number of problems with Deacon Hangen, who was the point man. The USCCB talks about an assistance coordinator and promises survivors the services of an assistance coordinator. Well, I was never at any point told of, introduced to, contacted by, given the card of an assistance coordinator. The only person I ever talked to was Deacon Phil Hangen. And then Hangen did this other thing. It took him, I thought he was going to get back to me in a couple weeks, but he ended up getting back to me a couple months later in July of 2011. And during that conversation, he asked to talk to my psychologist at the time, Dee. So I gave him Dee's contact information. And I actually remember this because I had to do it twice. As soon as I got off the phone with Hangen, I drove up to Dee's office and I filled out a form, a release form, giving Dee and Hangen permission to talk to each other. And I remember it because I actually had to fill it out twice, because the first time I filled it out, I just kind of gave Hangen access to anything and everything, because, you know, I had nothing to hide. I just wanted to fix the problem. But so then the next time we met, Dee took that form and tore it up, and he's like, okay, I'm going to give you a, let's fill this out in a more restricted manner that protects you and me and our relationship. And, you know, I'm fine with that, you know. So I filled that out and made sure that Dee had Deacon Hangen's information. And Hangen never got in touch with Dee. And Dee told me that he called Hangen and tried to get in touch with him and never heard back from him. He left a voicemail at the number that I gave him, and it was the right voicemail, and he never heard back from Deacon Hangen. And that actually became a problem and damaged my relationship with Dee, to the point where I stopped trusting him, because I didn't understand why he and Hangen never got in touch with each other. And what Dee told me was, in 20 years of doing this, I've never had someone who wanted to get in touch with me fail to get in touch with me, you know, which was good enough for me. And that, you know, and I think I literally had Dee swear on a Bible, say that he attempted to contact Deacon Hangen and Hangen never got in touch with him. So I have zero faith in Hangen. You know, for one thing, you know, he had lawyers at the meeting, and then he lied to me about when he was going to contact me and how soon he was going to contact me, and then he never called Dee back. So that created problems in our relationship. Things just completely devolved in there, you know, the relationship between Dee and me, because I couldn't trust him and I didn't understand why he and Hangen weren't talking and had never talked to each other. It was completely bizarre, and it freaked me out, and I couldn't understand what the hell was going on. You know, and you want to talk about gaslighting. This is, you know, that's a perfect example of gaslighting, where, you know, that they're telling me that the conversation, the two or three conversations I had with Cardinal Dolan, and then the meeting I had with the person who I assume was Nancy Brown, that they never happened. You know, that just, it literally drove me crazy. It made me question everything, made me wonder if I was going crazy. And I wonder if that was the intent. Now, the interesting thing is I was so bothered by that after the May 2011 meeting with the review team, I think they called it an investigatory team, I actually drove to Clayton and attempted to find Nancy Brown's office. Now, it took me like 5 or 6 years. It wasn't until, I think it was February 2016, that I was able to find where I went. And the crazy thing is I drove past it. I drove past that building literally 100 times. You know, every month or so I would drive through that area trying to find that office, because I knew where it was, but I couldn't see the building. It turns out it was at 141 North Merrimack in Clayton, Missouri, probably in suite 25, maybe suite 23. But like I said, it took me 5 or 6 years. I think it was 5 years to find it, to be able to see it. But you know, I know exactly where I was. I remember parking. I remember walking into the building. I remember where her office was. I remember what the view outside of her office was. It definitely happened, but it certainly freaked me out, and it affected me that they denied that happened, or that they told me that they had no record of that. But the interesting thing is that I recently talked to Bishop Rick Sticca, who's the Bishop of Knoxville, and he actually succeeded then Bishop, now Cardinal Dolan, in basically the fixer position for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And while he initially said and acted like he was going to help me, he didn't. But early on in our conversations, Bishop Sticca told me that he had seen and been inside Valentine's file, and there was no record of my phone conversations with Cardinal Dolan. There was no memo, you know, initiating contact. There was no record of my conversations with Nancy Brown. For some reason, for whatever reason, I don't know whether he was lying or whether it was the truth, just like the people in the May 2011 meeting, he told me that they had no record of my 2002 conversations with Cardinal Dolan and with Nancy Brown. I don't know if that was true. I don't know if Dolan tried to hide me and my existence from the Archdiocese, but the fact is that, you know, Sticca confirmed what I heard in 2011. So from that point on, Deacon Phil Hengen was my contact person, and I did have a few interactions with him, but I didn't trust him because, well, first of all, he never called D. He never called my psychologist. And that was the simplest thing in the world. Hengen, on a number of occasions, did tell me, send me a treatment plan, but he never offered to pay for its creation. And by that time, I was having, you know, so this is like 2012, 2013. I was having serious financial problems. The 2011 Jerry Sandusky Penn State stuff certainly didn't help me and affected me deeply. Kind of knocked me out for a lot of 2012. So Hengen did, on two or three occasions, say, essentially, send me a treatment plan, but he never offered to pay for it, and I have no idea how much it costs to create a treatment plan. I assume it's hundreds or thousands of dollars, but I was having money problems, and my parents couldn't afford to help me with therapy anymore, so even the $100, even if it costs $100 to put together a treatment plan, I didn't have the money for that, and Hengen never offered to pay for it, and it's... When I saw Nancy Brown, Dolan said that, you know, the Archdiocese would pay for that, and they did. I never got a bill for that, so I didn't understand why Hengen wouldn't offer to pay for the creation of a treatment plan. But the gist was, you know, I call him, my nickname for Deacon Hengen is Runaround Phil, because it you know, his whole job, and it seemed like all he did was he just gave me the runaround. He never actually did anything. He forced me to drive the process. I had to do all the contacts. He never contacted Doug. He wouldn't finance the creation of a treatment plan, never offered to. I was expected to drive the process, and I think it's crazy to expect the survivor of a traumatic event to drive the process. And that just, the fact that he and they would do that to me just completely devastated me and really knocked me out for a lot of 2012, to the point where I just literally couldn't function. I would just stare at the computer screen all day, and I just couldn't process stuff. Then in 2013, I was very surprised to find out that the Archdiocese of St. Louis permanently removed Father Valentine. There was just this announcement, and I was still seeing I don't know if I was still seeing her at the time, but I received a call from my second psychologist, Dr. M, on a Friday afternoon at like 5 o'clock or so, alerting me to the fact that there was an article in a couple of the local papers saying that the Archdiocese of St. Louis had removed Father Valentine. And that was totally news to me and completely blindsided me, because I had never, they never made any attempt via email, phone call, mail, snail mail. The Archdiocese of St. Louis never made any attempt to warn me or alert me of the fact that they were going to permanently remove Father Valentine, which obviously, you know, devastated me. I couldn't even, you know, and you want to talk about gaslighting and how something screws with your sense of what is real. That screwed with my sense of reality and made me feel, and really worsened this feeling that I literally didn't exist, that I was a ghost in the world and that I didn't actually exist in a material sense, that I was already dead and in limbo or purgatory. And, you know, I could see what was going on in the world, but I couldn't interact with the world. And that's, you know, that's what the Archdiocese removing Father Valentine and never contacting me, that's what it did to me and for me. And it just absolutely just destroyed me, that and when they would do that. And in the press release that accompanied that, they talked about the reason they were permanently removing Valentine was because of someone who'd come forward in the summer of 2012. And I was just thinking to myself, and I still think to myself, you know, why did you believe that person, but you didn't believe me? It wasn't the fact that you found that person believable, the person who came forward in the summer of 2012, wouldn't the fact that you believed them make my allegations and the things I told you, wouldn't that make it that much more believable? And that just freaked me out. And again, it just, I literally felt that I didn't exist, like I was a ghost, like I was stuck in purgatory, that I could see people and I could see what was going on, but I didn't actually exist in the world, which obviously, you know, which obviously became a problem. And then in June of 2013, by that time, my older son had kind of passed beyond the age that I was, but my younger son was right in the middle of the age that I was when all that stuff happened to me, you know, 10 or 11. And I was kind of obsessed with him and coaching him. And it turned out that one day someone pointed out to me a thing that was on my arm. I'd always had this mole about the size of a dime or so on my arm, you know, a birthmark. But it turned out that sometime prior to June of 2013, maybe May of 2013, at the same time Father Valentine was being removed, I had this thing, this lesion appeared on my arm. And I didn't know what it was. I couldn't afford to have it looked at, but it was pretty obvious what it was. It was a cancerous lesion, but because of the money problems I was having, I wasn't able to do anything about it. And I think that was before Obamacare passed. So I just had to kind of live with it, which sucks. So I'm dealing with all this dissociation from Valentine's removal and my not being acknowledged or contacted. And now I've got, you know, what sure looks like a cancerous lesion on my arm. But during 2013, I had gotten to know the pastor of the parish, Monsignor Haneke, that we rented another parish's field, a parish that didn't have a school, still had a field. So we rented that field and used it for our athletic fields. And I got to know the pastor of that parish. And I came to find out that he was the vicar for priests for the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And at the same time, you know, I was still trying to get help from Hangin, and Hangin was stonewalling me and giving me the runaround and expecting me to drive the process. And I didn't know how the Archdiocese was organized, but I knew that a Monsignor outranked a deacon. And Monsignor Haneke seemed like a nice guy, so I went to him and asked him for help in terms of dealing with Deacon Hangin. Essentially what I tried to do was go over Deacon Hangin's head in the hierarchy, but it turned out that Monsignor Haneke was actually Deacon Hangin's boss, and what I was interpreting and seeing as incompetence on Deacon Hangin's part, or, you know, a bureaucratic screw up, or the slow wheels of bureaucracy, wasn't that. It wasn't a screw up, it was a strategy. And it was a strategy that Monsignor Haneke and Hangin, and presumably someone above them, had concocted to basically just make me go away. So I approached Haneke in November of 2013, told him my story. He was very receptive the first meeting, but by the second meeting, he was like stone-faced and just said, you need to work through Hangin. And, you know, and I'm like, well, Hangin has just stolen all of me and given me the runaround. What am I supposed to do? And I just, you know, I just felt completely helpless. But, you know, I was trying to get help. I was trying to do the right thing. I was still assuming that the Archdiocese intentions were good. But they were just, you know, it was obvious that they didn't want to help me, and that I might have to force them to help me. So 2014 came around, and in January, as a result of a lawsuit, the Archdiocese of St. Louis produced what became known as the Matrix, which was basically a big Excel spreadsheet of complaints and accused priests. And that also freaked me out and reinforced this sense that I didn't exist, because the Matrix covered... It was like everyone who came forward to the Archdiocese between, I think it was 83 and 2005 or so, I believe. So my complaint, or my allegation that I made to Cardinal Dolan in March of 2002 and discussed with Nancy Brown in mid-March 2002, should have been in the Matrix, and it wasn't. And that, again, just destroyed me and devastated me and reinforced the sense that I didn't exist and that all this stuff was an illusion. But God, I could remember the conversations, and I knew where I was standing, and I knew what phone that I was talking on when I had the conversations with Dolan. And I remember what Nancy Brown's office looked like and what the building looked like. I couldn't find it. You know, I knew where it was. I just couldn't see it. And then that whole sense of hallucinations and, I guess, it's dissociation and disconnection from reality really came to a head on Easter of 2014, where the kids and their mom went to Easter Mass, and I stood on the back of the church, and what I would kind of do is fantasize that, you know, okay, I'm with them, but because the church is so crowded, I have to stand in the back of the church. And that's what I used to do when the kids were little and we were still together. So I tried to kind of entertain that fantasy. But the problem was, is that when the processional to start the church walked out, they were carrying incense. And this is Easter 2014, you know, like the 10 or 11 o'clock Mass. The processional walked out and they had incense. And I don't know if I'd ever smelled incense at Mary Queen of Peace before, but, you know, we used a lot of incense at Immaculata. And then in the procession was a seminarian dressed like we used to dress at Immaculata, with the black cassock and the white sheer curtain kind of thing, surplus or something, I forget what it's called. But I'd never seen anything like that at Immaculata, at Mary Queen of Peace, because at Mary Queen of Peace, the servers were mostly girls, and they wore these kind of white, robey kind of things, not the traditional server outfits. I hadn't seen a traditional server outfit like we used at Immaculata in probably 20 or 30 years. But then suddenly here was this guy standing next to me. And that led to what I don't know how to describe, but essentially every time I blinked, my eye level would shift and would drop about a foot. I don't know if it was a hallucination or an episode of dissociation or what, but it was this really, really, really powerful sense of that I was just living in a man suit, or that I wasn't real, and that every time I blinked, my eye level would, you know, would drop a foot, so that I was going back in time and I was unstuck in time. And, you know, obviously that just fed this whole sense of dissociation, and that I wasn't real, that I wasn't in the world, that I was like stuck in the world or in a parallel world, but wasn't able to interact with people. So obviously 2014 didn't go well. I was, you know, working and writing and stuff, but having a harder and harder time interacting with people. 2015 was much the same, but for some reason, I don't remember exactly why, I was able to finally get back in touch with some lawyers in March of 2015, and ended up filing a lawsuit in October of 2015. You know, and in the press release associated with that, I talked about, the main thing I talked about was, you know, special training and stuff that happened during the special training, and that the only reason that I filed the lawsuit, you know, I tried to settle it, and I very much did. You know, I made multiple attempts to try to force the church, when it was obvious they wouldn't voluntarily help me. I tried to kind of threaten them into helping me, you know, saying, you know, you need to do something, or I'm going to contact a lawyer. And they never cared. So I ended up in October 2015, having to file a lawsuit. And that was no fun, but it was necessary. And at least I was able to do it. Although it took me about 2 years to be able to get past this sense of unreality and actually be able to file that lawsuit. And that ended up being a problem, and because the gaslighting that the Archdiocese did created this sense. It created a problem with the statute of limitations, which is exactly what it was supposed to do, obviously. I was just so freaked out and so tripped out that I wasn't able to pull myself together until October 2015. You know, and there were also money problems associated with that. Filing a lawsuit isn't free. And that isn't the only thing the Archdiocese did. So I filed my lawsuit in October 2015. I filed it anonymously, and then I also filed it with my parents as friends. And that was because, you know, like I said, I kind of freaked out and just kind of disappeared in 2014 and 2015, and the lawyers saw that. So they had my parents come on as co-parties to the lawsuit, just so that they could, so that the lawyers would be able to talk to them and kind of push things forward, even if I was having a bad time, which, you know, completely made sense. But the first motion that the Archdiocese of St. Louis filed was to remove my parents as friends, which was obviously solely an attempt to psychologically isolate me and, reduce my ability to go through with the lawsuit. And fortunately, that motion was rejected, but just the mere fact that the Archdiocese would try that obviously freaked me out. Then, as I said, I think it was in February of 2016, I was able to finally able to see and to find the office where I met with Nancy Brown, you know, and I was, well, and then also at the same time in very early January 2016, I ended up having surgery for what turned out to be for the lesion on my arm, and it turned out to be malignant melanoma, but it was just like stage one or stage 1A. And I believe I was able to remove everything. Thank God for Obamacare, because, you know, that was the only thing that made it affordable. I still owe SLU Hospital $5,000 or $6,000. Well, SLU Hospital and my doctor $5,000 or $6,000, but at least Obamacare let me get the surgery and get the lesion removed, so it wouldn't get any worse. So that was early 2016. We went through the process of discovery, you know, turning over all my medical records. And I guarantee you that the Archdiocese of St. Louis, or at least their lawyers, knew that I was fighting cancer at the same time as I was fighting the Archdiocese of St. Louis, but they never, you know, they never showed any sign of caring. They never, you know, if they actually cared when I first filed the lawsuit, they would have tried to settle. When they found out through the discovery process that I had cancer, they would have tried to settle, but they never tried to settle the lawsuit. They didn't care. They just wanted to fight me. They didn't care anything about me. But then I was in early 2017, it became obvious that I had a problem with the statute of limitations because of how I had kind of freaked out and disappeared and dissociated in 2014 and 2015 as a result of the gaslighting and the Cardinal Dolan and Deacon Hengen and all the stringing along and run around that Hengen gave me. That created basically a 6-month problem with the statute of limitations, but that was enough for my lawyers to say, you know, we can't go any farther with this. We need to just try to settle this. And our initial offer was $100,000, and then we walked that down to $75,000, and then $50,000, and $25,000. While that seems like a lot of money, it's nothing compared. You know, I can get to $1 million personal injury, $2 million if you count the impact to my ex-wife and her family and everything. So $100,000 against $2 million is relatively nothing, but at least it would have paid for therapy. But the Archdiocese never came off of their offer of $15,000, which netted me $9,000 in September of 2017. So then in December of 2017, Cardinal Law died, and that freaked me out. Because in a press release put out by the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops, they talked about Law and lamented him, and he's such an awesome guy. And they also, kind of as a throwaway line, said, "Well, if you're a survivor of abuse, you should contact your local assistance coordinator." And that completely triggered me. And I had decided in September 2017 to take that settlement and try to use it to finance a social media campaign to try to force the Archdiocese to acknowledge what happened and help survivors. And that just really kind of got me going and energized me. So that in December 2017, I wrote a piece called The Second Sin that kind of lays out everything that I've discussed in this podcast and all the, you know, all the, just everything that they've done to me, since I first came forward in 2002 and tried to get help. As part of that process, I ended up getting an email from Sandra Price, who's the director of the Office of Child and Youth Protection. Essentially what I was trying to do is I was trying to blow the whistle to the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops and let them know that their promise of an assistance coordinator was a scam, at least in terms of St. Louis. And I ended up receiving an email back. I think it was part of that as a result of an email I sent to the USCCB, but Sandra Price, who's the director of the Office of Child and Youth Protection for the Archdiocese of St. Louis, in February 2018 sent me an email that I referenced in episode 1 that essentially admitted that it happened. You know, she said, your claims were acknowledged. There was a bunch of lies about that, but, you know, she used the word acknowledged, which sounds like she was saying it happened. And then right before the close, she said, "You and all survivors of abuse are in my prayers." And it took me, like I said, it took me 10 days to realize what she was saying, but she was admitting that it happened. Now, like I said, there were a whole bunch of lies in there, you know, saying that Hengen tried to help me and blah, blah, blah. But the fact was that she admitted that it happened. And I then took that email and kind of expanded this piece on The Second Sin that I have on medium.com, and then ended up getting the attention of Aisha Sultan, who's a columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and also has a syndicated column. And she wrote and released a piece in April of 2018, kind of giving a high-level overview of my story and kind of my ordeal trying to get help. And that piece led at least 2, maybe 3 other survivors to come forward, one of whom contacted me, and I've heard of a couple others contacting other people. They haven't contacted me yet. But the one guy who did came forward had very similar memories of, you know, interactions with Valentine and with Father, now Cardinal Dolan, back at Immaculata in the late 70s and the early 80s. It seems like I was obviously not the only person who was having interactions with Valentine and who Valentine was singling out and doing stuff too. Now the problem was that in that Aisha Sultan, April 2018, St. Louis Post-Dispatch piece, Gabe Jones, who's a spokesman for the Archdiocese of St. Louis, said, as I've said before, he said, you know, well, we can't say anything because of confidentiality agreements, which is garbage. There's no confidentiality agreement anymore because the lawsuit was settled. But they said, but we, you know, but I will say that O'Leary's story changed multiple times. And that's garbage. I would, if I were facing him and he said that, you know, to you or to an interview, I would immediately reply with from when to when, because, you know, as far as you know, and as far as you told me in 2011, I only told you my story once in 2011, by 2013 in my conversations with Hannegy, Father Valentine had already been removed. And in my 2011 meeting with, or my conversations with Dolan and my meeting with Nancy Brown, or 2011 conversations with the Archdiocesan review team, they told me they had no record of my 2002 conversations with Dolan and with Nancy Brown. So how can you say that something changed when I only told you my story once in 2011? That's what I would ask Gabe Jones and the Archdiocese. But obviously, he and the Archdiocese has never replied to that question that I've tried to ask through Twitter and social media. And then things really got bad where I started pressing, I started pressing the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops and CCing people at the Archdiocese of St. Louis, including Sandra Price. And every time that I would send an email to the USCCB trying to blow the whistle, or even just letting the USCCB know that the whole assistance coordinator thing was a sham, at least in St. Louis, the Archdiocese of St. Louis would call the police on me. And they did that at least twice, maybe three times. And that was, you know, that was obviously very unpleasant and freaked me out, and made me wonder for my, you know, worry about my safety. And it just, but it just gave me the sense of, you know, okay, these are the people that I'm dealing with. These are terrible people, narcissistic people who think that they're under attack when really all I'm trying to do is just, I'm just trying to get help, you know, first for myself and, you know, now just for other people. I want the Archdiocese of St. Louis to take survivors seriously. And I'm out of luck, but I know there are other survivors out there who are in desperate straits and who need help. And if I can help them, I'm going to help them. And as part of that process, a couple weeks ago, February, I think it was early September of 2018, I held a vigil outside of the mass of reparation that the Archdiocese of St. Louis held on a Friday night. And I just stood there just kind of staring down the cathedral basilica, holding a couple pictures of me and some other guys and Father Valentine, just to let people know that, you know, I'm a survivor and I've got pictures and I've got proof and you're not going to scare me. I can come and stare at you and hold you accountable. And the depressing thing is that while a bunch of lay people interacted with me, and I think they were mostly, they just wanted to take my name because I wonder if I'm on a list of like a security list and people who may pose a threat, blah, blah, blah. I've never threatened the Archdiocese. I have via Twitter expressed an ability and a capability to protect myself should anyone come after me. And I've had a number of people tell me that is a possibility, not a certainty, but a possibility. Nobody's tried anything, but you know, back in February, March, when I was thinking about coming forward, I didn't know what was going to happen. So I did express, I made it clear to people via Twitter that I have the ability to defend myself, but I've made it clear that was purely a defensive capability. And the Archdiocese then called the cops and said that I was threatening to hurt myself or someone else, which is nonsense. But so I held that vigil, and unfortunately, no priest and certainly not Archbishop Carlson, and these guys were just 30, 40 feet away from me, at the time I was holding the vigil and holding the pictures, none of the priests interacted with me. They wouldn't even look at me. They literally didn't even look at me. It was the strangest thing. It was like I wasn't there. And you want to talk about, again, this feeling of I don't exist. I don't exist in the same material plane. I'm in limbo. This feeling that feeds the dissociation and the PTSD, that's exactly what the continuing actions of the Archdiocese of St. Louis, that's what they're doing to me, and that's what they're doing to other survivors. So, to sum up, what's the big deal? You know, like a lot of survivors, I've lost everything. I'm divorced, lost the house, all but lost my family. I haven't declared bankruptcy, but I'm effectively bankrupt. I have thousands of dollars of outstanding loan to the doctor and to the hospital for my cancer surgery, and then other debts that are, you know, that far outweigh the assets that I have and the income that I have. And my income is declining. It's down about 50% just because of, you know, when you can't leave the house and you can't stand to promote your stuff, your business is gonna dwindle. And it's a big deal because it's not just, my problems are not just the result of the abuse, but they are, and I would actually argue they're probably more due to the re-abuse. I could argue that in some ways the biggest mistake I made was trying to come forward to get help, because that then exposed me to the re-abuse, and the re-abuse, all the gaslighting, and that created psychological problems that are far more devastating than the actual act of being raped were. And that's a crazy thing to say. You know, being raped is terrible, but being psychologically abused is worse. Because my body knew how to deal with the act of being raped, but it has no idea how to deal with just being ignored by the Archdiocese of St. Louis. And I still have major problems with PTSD that I'm, you know, not able to handle or to treat or to seek treatment for, and that I solved by not leaving the house. But again, that creates financial problems, that, you know, thus my GoFundMe campaign that I've started. And that's an issue because I've got, I think as a result of OCD, I've got some compulsive spending problems associated with certain products or items that take me back to the time of my abuse, or, you know, when kind of the re-abuse was happening, you know, just problems with trauma and related to trauma, physical trauma and psychological trauma. It's basically just this whole piling of abuse on top of abuse has taken this, this incredible toll on me. And I've had, you know, just practically, I've had productivity problems due to, the compulsion to reenact what happened to me. I've learned to manage that, quote unquote, manage it by learning to not fight it. I don't fight it, and I just get it out of the way. That's the way I deal with it, or quote unquote deal with it. But I don't know what to do in terms of the man suit stuff and the PTSD and the fear and the anger. I don't know how to handle that, you know, and that creates huge economic limits and thus an economic impact. And to close this, the thing that I would hope people would understand is that I'm not convinced that anything has changed. And I'm not just talking about the response to survivors, but I'm talking about the prevention of abuse. If you want to be scared, Google Father Sean Radigan, Kansas City. That's a case that's almost identical to mine. Very much the same things happened. And when the lay people tried to go through the process and, you know, let the Monsignor know and let the bishops know, nothing happened. The church authorities, the hierarchy, refused to intervene. They refused to do anything to fix the problem. And that's terrifying, and that's what continues to drive me. It's not just the problems that the survivors are experiencing and are facing. It's that kids remain at risk, and people need to understand that. And that's why this was a big deal, and that's why it continues to be a big deal, and why I need your help, and why survivors need your help, and why, to be honest, kids need your help.